From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's archive edition of Fresh Air, violinist Itzhak Perlman. We'll talk with him about his life and his recent forays into klezmer music. He's currently touring the country with the Klezmer Orchestra. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz reviews a recording by a young virtuoso, violinist Gil Shaham. A documentary series on European silent film premiered on Turner Classic Movies this week, co-produced by the award-winning film historian Kevin Brownlow. We'll feature an interview with Brownlow about silent movies. And film critic John Powers reviews Striptease. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Nora Rahm. The U.S. is coming under criticism from world leaders at the G7 Economic Summit in France. In a communique, the U.S. was denounced for its policy of threatening retaliation against foreign companies doing business with the known terrorist nations of Cuba, Iraq, and Iran. President Clinton signed the legislation into law after Cuban military fighters downed two American civilian aircraft in international waters. G7 leaders also issued a list of general economic agreements. At a news conference in Lyon, Treasury Secretary Robert Rubin said the list includes easing the debt of third world nations.
The leaders agreed on a comprehensive approach for alleviating the debt burden of the poorest nations, so that those nations, if they agree to sound reform policies, will be able to manage their debt burden and succeed economically.
G7 leaders also agreed to work closely in foreign exchange markets and to abide by rules set by the World Trade Organization. The Supreme Court today struck down a federal law designed to restrict access to smut on cable TV. The 1992 Cable Act requires local cable companies to either ban such shows or put all of them on a single channel and block them from children. The justices said the law violated free speech protections under the U.S. Constitution. The decision produced six separate opinions, but the result was that the law, which was never enforced, now will not take effect. The Supreme Court also today upheld a new federal law that makes it harder for inmates on death row to appeal their sentences. Russian President Boris Yeltsin's absence at a Kremlin meeting today set off new speculation about his health less than a week before a runoff presidential election. But an aide to Yeltsin insisted the president is fine and was spending the day working in private. NPR's Ann Cooper reports from Moscow.
Yeltsin was supposed to show up for a meeting with farmers this morning, but Prime Minister Viktor Chernomyrdin announced he would not be able to attend. Chernomyrdin said the stress of the election campaign had affected Yeltsin's voice. Yeltsin's press secretary confirmed the president had lost his voice, but said he was otherwise in good form. Last year, Yeltsin suffered two heart attacks, but he appeared in good health during the first round of presidential campaigning this month. On Wednesday, Russians vote in the presidential runoff between Yeltsin and his communist opponent, Gennady Zyuganov. Today, Yeltsin rejected Zyuganov's proposal for a televised pre-election debate, saying, "I have nothing to discuss with him." I'm Ann Cooper in Moscow.
On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up 13.67 points at 5691.20 in heavy trading of 174 million shares. This is National Public Radio News. The man who gathered FBI background files on Republicans at the White House has refused to testify before the Senate Judiciary Committee because he said he might incriminate himself. Anthony Marcesa did not himself appear before the panel this morning, but he sent a letter from his lawyer to invoke the Fifth Amendment. He is a civilian employee of the Army. Just 2 days ago, he testified freely concerning the files. More charges have been lodged against the man suspected of being the Unabomber. The Justice Department announced today that Theodore Kaczynski has been charged with attacks in Utah, Tennessee, and Michigan. Commerce Secretary Mickey Cantor says he welcomes yesterday's House vote to uphold China's most favored nation trading status. Cantor is in Bangkok as part of a swing through Asia to push for further opening of those markets to U.S. exports. NPR's Mary Kay Magstead reports.
Mickey Cantor said he's just delighted that the House voted almost 2-1 to continue China's most favored nation trading status. He said the vote supports what he called President Clinton's wise policy of constructive engagement with China. A vocal minority of representatives had wanted to rescind China's MFN status on the grounds of its continuing human rights abuses, copyright piracy, and alleged sales of nuclear technology to Pakistan. But other representatives argued that such a move would hurt U.S. businesses as well as China, and that continuing China's MFN status made good economic sense. Cantor said even with the renewal of MFN, the Clinton administration will continue its pressure on China to clean up copyright piracy and live up to the agreements it has signed. I'm Mary Kay Magstead reporting.
German radio is putting out a greatest hits collection, the best party songs, that is, Communist Party songs. The 26-track CD includes propaganda songs of Germany and the Soviet Union, for example, the title track, The Party is Always Right. I'm Noor Rahm, National Public Radio News in Washington.
Support for Fresh Air comes from Ferrer, Straus & Giroux, publishers of Lush Life, a new biography about jazz legend Billy Strayhorn. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guest, Itzhak Perlman, is perhaps the best-known and most popular classical violinist of his generation. He's reached a wide audience through his performances on public television, on shows ranging from great performances to Sesame Street. Perlman is currently on tour with several bands at the forefront of the klezmer revival. Klezmer music is a form of Jewish pop that is played at ceremonies and parties. It's a hybrid of traditional melodies from Eastern Europe and the sounds of jazz and vaudeville. Perlman grew up in Israel. His parents emigrated there from Poland in the early 30s as part of the Zionist movement. His extended family remained in Poland and perished in the Holocaust. Perlman's recent PBS special featured him performing klezmer music with some of the bands he's now touring with. I spoke with him last November after the release of a companion CD called Itzhak Perlman in the Fiddler's House. This track features Perlman with the Klezmer Conservatory Band. Itzhak Perlman, is this the first time you've played klezmer music?
Yes, absolutely. I'm a little surprised that it's the first time because I have not really, I've been living with it actually since I was born. You know, it's in Israel and so on. And then so it was, when somebody told me, how would you like to play it? I was a little, I almost asked myself, why didn't I do it before? It was something very, very, very natural. Of course, I was a bit apprehensive because I've never played it. But once I started, you know, it took me about 2 or 3 minutes to get in the groove, and the rest was just a lot of fun.
So now that you've learned to play klezmer music, yeah. What's different from what you're used to?
I don't know if I've learned yet, but I'm happy.
You've been doing it anyway.
I'm happy that I can do a little bit of it. I suppose there are certain things, I don't know how you can call them in klezmer music. I know in jazz you call them licks, where everybody has a certain kind of way of doing things. In klezmer music, it's the same thing. In klezmer music, actually, there's one element that does not exist in any other kind of music, and it's called the krechts. Now, the krechts actually translated, it's a Jewish word, which means basically groan. I don't know if it means really groan. It's a groan with, this, you know, some things in Yiddish you can't really translate properly. But I think so the closest thing is a groan, maybe a sob. I think a sob and a groan together could be a good definition of what a krechts is. And it has to do with certain things that you do on the instrument. And if you, you know, you can play one phrase. You know, one of the interesting questions that I thought, you know, occurred during the time that I played was that a lot of these klezmer tunes and melodies and so on have origins of Hungary or Romania, you know, Eastern Europe and so on. And you know, so I said to somebody, you know, if you play a Romanian tune, let's say, or what we call was associated with gypsy violin and so on. What would be the difference between, let's say, a gypsy tune and a Jewish tune if you play it the same? Because, you know, there is certainly a closeness to something like that. And they said, well, it would be the krechts, that in a gypsy tune you would not have that sob. You would have something else. You would have different slides, different shifts, and so on. While at the minute you do something like this in a Jewish tune, it would immediately give it a stamp. So it was, you know, for me it was a real education.
So technically, how do you get that sob out of the violin?
Oh, technically, I can't describe. You know, you just touch one note before another. I mean, you know, it's a way that when you wanna play one note, you know, there is always another note that you touch before you play that one, and that gives you that. You know, it's like a little small. It's, you know, I almost feel that it shouldn't be described. You know, it should just be heard.
The television show about klezmer music took you to some synagogues in Eastern Europe in towns in which there are no Jews left anymore. What was that experience like for you?
Well, we were specifically in Krakow, and we were at the Jewish quarter there, which was totally, abandoned. There are about, I'm told, about maybe at this moment, maybe 200 Jews left there. Out of about 75,000 at the height of its, during the 40s and 30s, I suppose. The most incredible thing about it was that it was a ghost town, and that I suppose, luckily or unluckily, the synagogues, I suppose that's good, the synagogues were not destroyed. There were about five or six synagogues that are still standing there, and another 19 houses of learning, you know, shtiebels, what they call them, where they used to study Talmud and et cetera and everything else in school. And of course, the good thing about it is that you can see what it was like. The depressing thing about it was that it's minus the most important element, which is the population.
Right.
And so it was a kind of a bittersweet experience for us. We went to they actually are. It's becoming a bit chic almost to do things Jewish there. You know, there was of course a klezmer festival in Krakow, where that's one of the reasons that we were there, because some of the groups gather there and we play to a lot of enthusiastic people there. We all gathered in a restaurant which was in the middle of the Jewish quarter, which served authentic Polish Jewish food that, you know, I would close my eyes and it would be like my mother used to make it. But yet it was not, you know, it was not Jewish. It was just sort of in the style. So it was very strange, you know, to go into a place like this and you see, you know, a menorah, Hanukkah menorah on the wall, and, you know, and things that look a little bit like home and so on, and yet it's almost like a make believe,
almost like a theme park rather than an actual cultural experience.
Exactly, and that, for me that was very strange, very strange.
Let me play something from the new klezmer record, Itzhak Perlman, In the Fiddler's House. I think I'll play Hunger. Am I saying that right? By the Klezmer?
Hunger's fine. That's a nice, happy little tune there.
Do you want to say anything about it?
Well, yes, I can tell you one thing. I can tell you that this tune we recorded at 12 midnight. That was the first day we recorded that tune. So, you know, we were really into it, you know, but it was like, almost reminded me of, you know, when you hear some of those old jazz recordings where the guys don't start recording until like 12 or 1 in the morning, you know, and so on. This was done at the end of a very, very long session, and we were really going at it and so on. So you're listening to something that was done at the very, very end of session, and we were just very warmed up.
Thank you.
That's Itzhak Perlman with the Klezmatics from the new CD, Itzhak Perlman in the Fiddler's House. We'll talk more with Perlman after a break. This is Fresh Air. Back with violinist Itzhak Perlman. Now, I understand you were interested in the violin as young as 3 and a half.
Yes.
How were you exposed to classical music? Where did you hear it?
Radio. Just radio. That's all you heard there. At that time, there was the ratio of classical music to other kinds of music was a little, bigger. And so there was a lot of stuff that was going on there. I always say that... At that time, overtures by Suppé and Rossini were what was considered pop music. and so I listened to a lot of, it was always on the radio. I didn't really have a chance to go to too many concerts at that time. But I do remember, actually, one incident where my mother wanted to take me to a recital that Isaac Stern was giving in Tel Aviv. And they wouldn't let me in because they felt I was too young. It was one of those first traumatic experiences having to do with trying to get into a concert hall, and not, they won't let me. So I remember that. But we were very much, my parents were very much aware that I was very interested in music. So that's how it went.
You weren't let in because they were afraid you'd cry in the middle of the concert?
Yeah, that's right, yeah. They felt it was too young to have somebody 3 and a half to just go to a grown-up concert.
When you were 4, you got polio.
Yes.
And spent, a lot of time in the hospital?
No, I spent about, I would say, maybe 6 weeks. That was, sort of from beginning to finish of the, whatever the disease was going through. And after about 6 weeks, I went to, I came back home, and then we went through a whole bunch of rehabilitation and things like that. But by about 4 and a half, I was already all set, and towards 5, I started to play again.
You were very young. I mean, you might not have even had the words yet, the vocabulary yet, to describe what you were physically experiencing. Were you terrified during that period, or was the lack of knowledge that you had as a child useful in a way?
Well, yeah, I did not particularly. I felt that was what happened. In other words, I was explained. That this particular that polio makes you not be able to walk. So that was it. And then they said, because of that, you're going to have to be fit with leg braces. And I said, fine, and so on. And when you're a kid, you learn to adapt very easily. And I did. And the thing is that, of course, I had, I started to go to school, just regular school. My parents moved to a neighborhood where... school was close to our apartment, and then of course music lessons and so on. So I proceeded with my life.
You were discovered in Israel by Ed Sullivan. What was he doing in Israel?
Ed Sullivan, of course, was the most incredible television person, because his show was, whatever was new, whatever was interesting, whatever was funny, whatever was unusual, he would have on his show. And one of the ideas that he had at one point is to come to Israel and to choose Israeli people in different modes of performance to come to his show and to have a show just made out of Israeli acts, if you want to call it. So I was one of the acts. I was. They had on that show. I know that they held national auditions, and I was sort of lucky enough to get into the finals, if you want to call it that. And I played for him, and then he said, yes, I would like him to come. And that show had like a dance troupe. They had a couple of duo pianists played, you know, classical stuff. They had folk songs. They had folk singers. They even had a person who did shadows on a screen of famous political figures. You know, he would do a shadow of Stalin. You know, can you imagine at that time doing a shadow of Stalin or Ben-Gurion or somebody like that and so on? So we had everybody there, and I was, you know, I was doing my abbreviated version of the last movement of the Mendelssohn Violin Concerto. Really abbreviated. I mean, is abbreviated the correct way?
Yeah.
You know, very short, 3 minutes. So that was it. So, but that's the way I came, you know. And then I appeared a couple of more times on the show at that same period of time.
So the first time you were in the U.S., it was to appear on the Ed Sullivan
Yes,
Show.
Yes.
Did you have any idea what the show was like? It was such an institution for Americans, but you were, of course, from another country.
Yeah. Well, we heard in Israel that was the show. You know, so, and the thing is that anything American that you heard in Israel at that time was, you know, something very, very exciting. But we said that this guy has the show on television, that millions of people are watching it and so on. So it was very exciting.
So you came to New York for the Ed Sullivan Show, and then you stayed. You got a scholarship at Juilliard. Your parents came over from Israel,
yes,
to
mm-hmm.
be with you,
mm-hmm.
And I think your father ended up folding shirts in a laundry in Manhattan.
Well,
in the
no,
early years?
My father did a lot of things. He mm-hmm. didn't just know. He didn't, you know. He had stuff that he learned, you know, in order to go into the States. He did, you know, he started to do things like making wigs. You know, he would work in a print shop. You know, he did any job that he could get so that, you know, he could help support, you know, helps us being supported and so on. So he did a lot of the stuff.
When you were starting your performance tour, was access a problem for you? You walk with
yeah.
canes and braces. And
yeah.
America, I think, has come a long way.
Well, I tell you, we've come a long way, but it's still not very good. I mean, you still, if you go to, just recently played in a place where I had to go down one flight of stairs. So it all depends, you know. It all depends on the architect. It depends on the concert hall, and I'm talking about new concert halls too that are still problematic. Not to mention the old ones. It's so funny, you know. The excuse is there, you know. The minute something is not right, we said it's not quite accessible. They said, oh well, you know, this was built 10 years ago, or this was built 20 years ago, or this was built 30 years ago, as though there were no people with disabilities 30 years ago. So. But, you know, people are certainly more aware of what the problems are. But it's still, I mean, it's still for me a crapshoot, you know, that sometimes you go to a city and it might be okay. And sometimes it might not. So, and again, people have a very, very wrong way of thinking about what access means. You know, people think that access means to get into a place, period. Whether you get into a place through a freight elevator or through a garbage elevator is not the point. Just get to the place. For me, access has to do also with getting into a place with dignity and getting into a place with where other people can get in the same place with you. In other words, not to have to go specially to a special entrance or to have a guard open the door for you while if you ring them, 20 minutes in advance to make sure to make arrangements to let you in. For me, that's not access. For me, that's inconvenience. Access is that if I want to get into a place, whether it's backstage or for the front, then I can just do it. And, you know, I suppose there are more places that are conscientious of that. There are, definitely. But still, we have a very long way to go.
One last question. What have you been listening to lately at home or in your car?
Oh, lately? Oh, well, a lot of Beatles, obviously. You know, what's been going on right now?
Uh-huh.
It's like a new revolution. So I've been listening to that. And just the normal things. You know, I always have this mixture of classical and golden oldies, which I still love to listen to, you know, from my days of listening to these things. I'm talking about 57, 58, 59, and into the 60s and so on. So I listen to a lot of that. And, of course, the fresh air. Use that as a commercial.
Well, gee, I want to thank you so much for talking with us.
My pleasure.
Itzhak Perlman recorded last November after the release of his klezmer CD, Itzhak Perlman in the Fiddler's House. He'll perform with the Klezmer Orchestra July 2nd at Radio City Music Hall in New York, July 16th at the Ravinia Festival in Chicago, July 29th in Philadelphia, and August 6th in Saratoga, New York. In a couple of minutes, Lloyd Schwartz will review a CD by a young violin virtuoso. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from the Crown Publishing Group, publisher of Miss Manners Rescues Civilization from Sexual Harassment, Frivolous Lawsuits, Dissings, and Other Lapses in Civility by Miss Manners Judith Martin. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up from the archives, film historian Kevin Brownlow tells us why the silent film era wasn't as innocent as you might think. He's collaborated on a new documentary series on European silent films, which premiered on Turner Movie Classics this week. Also, John Powers reviews the new movie, Striptease. This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. After Bach and Mozart, most of the great composers who wrote violin concertos wrote only one. A major exception is Prokofiev. His two violin concertos, as well as his sonata for solo violin, are featured on a new recording by the young violinist Gil Shaham. Classical music critic Lloyd Schwartz has a review.
Given what's happened to music since Prokofiev started to work on his first violin concerto in 1915, it's hard to imagine that at one time, violinists found this exquisite and scintillating music unplayable. It took 2 years for Prokofiev to finish the concerto, and with the Russian Revolution intervening, 5 more years before it first got played in public. In Paris, under one of Prokofiev's first champions, conductor Serge Koussevitzky, it eventually entered the standard repertory thanks mainly to the tireless advocacy of the great violinist Joseph Sigeti, who made the first recording of it in 1935. Ironically, today the violin concertos are where you turn when you want to hear some of Prokofiev's most beautiful melodies. Prokofiev's second violin concerto from 1935 is, if anything, more rhapsodic, more sugary than the first. Yasha Heifetz owned it the way Sigeti owned the first. Now they both belong to 25-year-old Gil Shaham. Shaham was born in Champaign, Urbana, Illinois, and moved to Israel when he was 2. He made his debut at 10 with the Jerusalem Symphony and later studied at Juilliard. I first heard him at Tanglewood a couple of summers ago. I was picnicking on the lawn during a pre-symphony chamber recital. He was playing a Prokofiev sonata. The performance was so riveting, it made me stop my munching to watch and listen. To my surprise, this young virtuoso wasn't writhing about and tossing his hair. The passion and energy were coming out of the violin itself. Among all the hotshot young violinists out there, Shaham strikes me as one of the few serious musicians. On his new disc, the two Prokofiev concertos and the later, very appealing sonata for solo violin have a driving sense of musical direction and inner logic. So many virtuosos play Prokofiev to show off their phenomenal technique. Shaham has technique to burn, but he doesn't need to display it for its own sake. And he avoids the other pitfall to which performers of these concertos are prone, sentimentalization. In 1979, Jerome Robbins used the first concerto to make a ballet for Baryshnikov called Opus 19, The Dreamer. It presented a sappy, self-pitying image of the lonely artist. But Shaham, like Sigeti, captures Prokofiev's edgy sense of danger and playfulness, as well as the sweetness of this dream. Even Andrei Previn, who can be a rather slack conductor, leads the London Symphony Orchestra with a rare, rhythmic bite. He seems galvanized by Shaham. Who wouldn't be?
Lloyd Schwartz is classical music editor of the Boston Phoenix. He reviewed a new recording of Prokofiev violin music by Gil Shaham. Coming up, silent film historian Kevin Brownlow. This is Fresh Air. The silent film era has been celebrated for its innocence, but my guest Kevin Brownlow says the silent era recorded another America: gangsters, corrupt politicians, syphilis, discrimination, unemployment. Brownlow's book, Behind the Mask of Innocence, attempted to set the record straight by examining films of social conscience in the silent era. Brownlow is one of the world's leading silent film historians. He also collects and restores silent films. He restored Abel Gance's 1927 silent epic, Napoleon. He also co-produced a documentary trilogy on Charlie Chaplin, Buster Keaton, and Harold Lloyd, which you may have seen on public television. He co-produced the six-hour documentary series showing this week on Turner Classic Movies called Cinema Europe, about the lost history of Europe's first films. I spoke with Brownlow in 1991 and asked him why he loves silent film.
I think it's because I was a kid at school and they used to show us films every third weekend, and they couldn't afford talking pictures, and so they showed us silence. And although I wasn't then so impressed by the films themselves, what fascinated me was the fact that you could have a cinema in your own home, you could have a movie theatre in your own home. And so I badgered my parents to get me a projector. And I got one for my 11th birthday. And only two films came with it, and they both only lasted 2 minutes. So I started hunting for more. And I found a whole pile of silent films in a shop off Baker Street and brought them back and ran them to my parents. And my mother recognized Douglas Fairbanks and William S. Hart and Bessie Love, all the stars that she'd grown up with. So I thought, this must be worth something. So I went to the library, took out a book on the history of the cinema, and it fell open at a picture of the Douglas Fairbanks film I had. And so that persuaded me that there must be some value in these films. And gradually, I found more and more of them and discovered that they were extremely well made and extremely well photographed and actually more interesting as films than some of the stuff I was looking at in the local cinema.
It's so remarkable to me that you could have found footage, in junk stores and, you know, local fairs and things like that.
These were prepared for home movie use. They were abridged versions of complete features. And there were some very rare things on them. And, two of the reels I found were from a film called Napoleon. But the American films impressed me tremendously, both for their vitality and their technical perfection at a very early date, And so I started researching. As a matter of fact, I was supposed to do sport at school every afternoon. Instead of that, I went to the British Film Institute and began and began looking them up in old magazines. And that was a thrilling detective work because they had actually changed the titles for home movie use. So you had to find out what they were by a process of trial and error and just ploughing through all the releases till you found the description that matched.
Well, a little later, I want to get back to some of the detective work you've done in your collecting of movies, and we'll talk also about how you piece together the epic Napoleon. But now I want to talk a little bit about your new book, Behind the Mask of Innocence. You write that silent films are usually seen as representing an era of innocence, but they didn't really.
That's right. As you asked me what turned me on to silent films in the first place, when I became a filmmaker, I felt that they had been slandered, that people regarded them as jerky, flickering, technically inept curiosities, and I wanted to change that picture. And then as I researched them, I found that the prevailing mood was one of sentimental nonsense, hokum, as the Americans called it, melodrama, and that the however well-made the film was, people tended to dismiss the story as being ridiculous and antique and quaint. And I felt that there must have been films made about social issues of the time. There must have been films about the immigrants, and there must have been films about women's suffrage and things like that. I must say it took a long time to find any evidence of them. But once I did, it turned into an avalanche, and I was absolutely staggered that so many films were made that we know so little about, and alas, most of them have been destroyed.
My guest is Kevin Brownlow, who's really one of the world's leading authorities on silent films. You know, the early silent movies raise a lot of interesting questions when you're talking about social films, because some of those films had to do with violence or sexuality. And this is the first time that people started asking questions about the degree of explicit sexuality or explicit crime that was going to be shown on the screen and what effect that would have on the people who saw it. What were some of the early ways those questions were raised, and what were some of the early fears that were expressed?
Well, right from the very start, when pictures first began to move, people started using them as an excuse. And the great train robbery of 1903, you can't get much earlier as far as story films go than that, already a young offender said, I was influenced by that picture to do this terrible crime. If I hadn't seen that film, I wouldn't have done it. and so the churchmen and the women's clubs, they started getting rather anxious about these pictures. And in 1906, I think it was, Harry Thaw shot the famous architect Stanford White when he discovered that his wife had been his mistress and before they were married. And this scandal made many people turned into a film. One of them, I think, came out 2 days after the event. And this series of films were the first to show the working class and immigrant audiences how the upper crust lived. And these were the people who made their laws and controlled their lives. And the middle classes were shocked that such things could be viewed by ordinary working people, and so it made them, the Thaw films made them shut theaters down.
So the earlier censorship that you're talking about is really what precedes the Hays Office and the Hollywood Production Code.
Yes, Hays didn't come in till 1922, and he was brought in because there was a series of scandals in Hollywood which threatened the family audience. The studio heads realized that unless they did something, they would lose that vital audience. And they did what the baseball people did when the World Series was fixed. They brought in a neutral figure who became known as the Tsar of all the Russias. And he really did a lot of harm because he emasculated stories which would otherwise have been getting stronger all the time, getting more interesting, more political and more engaged, and he made them blander. So that the great period of social films, where virtually every subject under the sun was tackled, was before his arrival up to 1921.
Kevin Brownlow is my guest. He's an expert on silent films. He restored the 1927 film silent film classic Napoleon, and he's the author of a new book about social films of the silent film era called Behind the Mask of Innocence. I think all of the silent films were made on nitrate film, which has a fairly short shelf life. Can you explain what the problem is with nitrate film, the problems with storage, and the problems with durability?
Yes, nitrate is known to be very inflammable, and as a result, people have created a scare. To such an extent, studios and private collectors have thrown it out. They won't have it anywhere near them in case it explodes like a hand grenade. But in fact, it's been an awful lot of nonsense being talked about it, because you drive around in a car with petrol in your tank, you don't set light to that, and it's no more dangerous than that. However, it can decompose because it's got animal fat in its makeup, and this is the most distressing aspect of it. It was expected to last 50 years, and the silent era itself was history 60 years ago. So we're talking about film which has miraculously lasted. And there's not a, you know, about two-thirds of the silent era is already lost. So we're talking about the remaining third. Some of that has already been copied by archives onto safety stock. Now, the rest of it must be done, because this is the last decade of nitrate. And if we don't do it, posterity will regard it as one of the greatest cultural crimes.
Well, I think one of the things you're proving is that we really don't fully know what the silent film era was like, since so much of the movies have been lost.
Particularly those years before the 20s started. We have, during that period, there was something called the three-reeler that was very popular. And the three-reeler, because it was an awkward length, was never kept, and hardly any of them survive, and yet the most interesting subjects were made in that peculiar length. It lasted, you know, about half an hour, 40 minutes, depending the speed you ran it at. And some remarkable pictures were produced, and some series about capital versus labor, and about the early gangsters, and the patent medicine racket, and it's absolutely fascinating.
You know, speaking to you is really getting me enthusiastic about going to the video store and renting some silent films, and more of them are coming out on video. I'll be honest with you, I've never rented a silent film on video. It always seems like it will be an incomplete experience watching it on a small screen without music, or at least without live music. I wonder if you've had the experience of watching silence on video, and what you think of it.
Well, I think watching films on video is an incomplete experience. I think a whole generation has lost the thrill of seeing a picture in the cinema as it was meant to be seen, with an audience reacting strongly to it and adding that reaction to their own. And then they look at the same film. If you look at the same film on video, it's never anything like the same. However, there are some excellent examples on video. In fact, my partner and I, my partner David Gill and I, have prepared some, including Ben-Hur, the 1925 Raymond Navarro version, and Carl Davis has written a fantastic score for it, the Garbo film Flesh and the Devil, quite a number of them, King Vidor's The Crowd, and King Vidor's Show People, which is one of the funniest pictures of that period. So there are some fine pictures available on video, but they should be done with the best possible quality and also the best quality score. And that sometimes lets it down. Sometimes you get a silent film which is ghastly quality in every sense. The music, too, is just a piano. But that brings me back to the thing that got me going in the first place, that it was the technical perfection of these films which amazed me, that photographically they were always extremely good. And it's the copying over the years that has made them look, he's given them that murky look. And alas, videotape is not the ideal medium for them. You should really see a really good print projected with a cart, with an arc, or with a really good light behind it on a big screen, and preferably live music.
You restored the 1927 French silent film Napoleon, which was directed by Abel Gance. I'm sure a lot of detective work went into finding the film. I think you'd said that you saw the first part of it when you were around 11 years old, but that was just a couple of minutes that you saw, right?
No, it was a couple of reels, and which would have lasted 20, 25 minutes. And it was enough to convince me that this was some of the finest filmmaking I'd ever seen. I go out on a limb and say it was the finest filmmaking I'd ever seen. And if the rest of the film is as good as that, then it, you know, I must get the rest of it. Well, it took years and years and years, but it was one of the most extraordinary things. The more I found, the better the picture got, until the version that we're running in Europe now is 5 hours 13.
Well, that's longer than the version that was in the States a few years ago, isn't it?
Considerably longer, yes. Yes, it is. And we're constantly finding more.
Where are you finding more and more footage from this?
Well, now footage is being dredged up from the archives of the Cinémathèque Française, and is not a great deal, but there's another 5 minutes to be sneaked in somehow, if we can afford to do it. But every time you put more footage in, you have to pay to change the score. And if I could tell you that it costs £2,000 just to Xerox the score, you can see how expensive it is.
Given Brownlow, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you very much indeed.
Given Brownlow co-produced the documentary series on European silent film called Cinema Europe, which concludes tonight on Turner Classic Movies. He's the author of a history of American silent film called The Parades Gone By. Our interview was recorded in 1991. Coming up, a review of the new film Striptease. This is Fresh Air. Striptease is the much-anticipated summer movie starring Demi Moore. It's based on the best-selling novel by Carl Hiaasen. What will Hiaasen fans think of the movie? Our film critic John Powers has some thoughts.
Before I'd even seen the new comedy thriller Striptease, I already knew that I'd be using my review to make fun of Demi Moore. Her wooden acting, her self-importance, her obsession with showing off that sexy bod. Then I saw the movie and discovered that I had a serious problem. Demi is the best thing in it. She plays Erin Grant, a divorcee who loses custody of her daughter Angela to her crooked ex-husband, a creep who supports himself by stealing wheelchairs. To finance an appeal, Erin takes a job stripping at a topless bar in Fort Lauderdale. There she becomes the erotic obsession of a sleazy womanizing congressman, played by Burt Reynolds, who's decked out in a pale wig that sits on his head like a cheese omelet. Since the congressman is up for re-election, his backers are prepared to do anything to keep his reputation intact, including commit murder. Caught up in all this, Erin keeps on stripping in order to win Angela back.
It's going to cost me $15,000 for this appeal. I mean, is there even a remote chance that I can make that in 6 weeks?
You're going to have to dance day and night and hope some Arab sheik shows up.
I love you girls. I really do. But I can't be working here when I go back to court. Oh, yes, Your Honor. I found a new job. I'm working at the Eager Beaver.
Hey, this is honest work. You have nothing to be ashamed of. Ugh.
God, it's 8 weeks and I still get nauseous before I have to go out there.
You get over it.
Really?
Striptease is based on a bestseller by Miami journalist Carl Hiaasen. While Hiaasen is by no means the best crime writer that city has produced, Charles Williford is more original, Elmore Leonard much sleeker, he does have a genuine gift for dark social comedy. His books are populated with a distinctly Floridian cast of fools and knaves, and he puts them through their paces with a cynicism that is simultaneously cheerful and ruthless. If only the same could be said for the movie. It was written and directed by Andrew Bergman, who specializes in genial, cockeyed comedies like The Freshman and Honeymoon in Vegas. Bergman knows how to have fun with the silliness of strip bars, like the owner's scheme to have his dancers wrestle topless in creamed corn. but he doesn't have a clue how to handle the story's nastier shadings, especially the subplot about the corrupt congressman and the murderous sugar plantation owners who use him as their puppet. Bergman seems unsure whether he's making a lighthearted romp, a wicked black comedy, or the touching story of a mother and her daughter. And so, the picture winds up being a crude mishmash. Nowhere is it broader than in the performance of Burt Reynolds, who talks in a southern accent so thick it sounds like he's gargling hush puppies. He turns the congressman into such a gibbering, smirking, drooling buffoon that you writhe in embarrassment at seeing this once-dashing star grovel so desperately for laughs. Which brings us back to Demi Moore, who holds the movie together with her good humor and down-to-earth manner. This is her warmest performance in several years, especially in the scenes with Angela, who's played by her real-life daughter. Although Moore is famous for her cold, ambitious, sexually fraught characters, she's something of a 90s Joan Crawford, she's almost perfectly cast as an energetic working-class mom like Erin, brittle on the outside, but soft within. Maybe that's who she really is, beneath her stardom. In any case, she should be seeking the kinds of roles that Crawford used to get, perhaps an updated version of Mildred Pierce. Moore was paid $12 million to star in Striptease, not least because she's asked to keep baring her chest and shaking her fanny for the camera. The filmmakers obviously think of her nakedness as their one surefire selling point, and they serve it up whenever possible. In a sheerly commercial sense, it's hard to fault them. While the rest of the movie is fumbling and crass, Demi looks terrific strutting her stuff on the stage of the Eager Beaver. Who says there are no great roles for women anymore?
John Powers is film critic for Vogue. Fresh Air was produced this week by Fred Landerl. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, and Alan Tu, with Barbara Bogave and Louisa Shafia. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Our theme music was composed by Joel Forrester and performed by the Microscopic Septet. I'm Terry Gross.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Verve Records, presenting Now is the Hour, a new CD of romantic jazz moods from Charlie Hayden's Quartet West. Their website address is verveinteractive.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.